Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision,
Oh,
right?
yeah, but like straight up engineering.
Exactly. You break your arm, you go in, the x-ray shows this jagged white line, and the doctor just points at it, and there it is, broken or not broken.
He's clean.
It's clean, it's visible, and honestly, it's comforting because it's so neatly categorized. But when you step into the world of neurodevelopment and trauma,
Oh, wow.
yeah.
Yeah, that x-ray machine is just completely broken.
Completely. We end up looking at a diagnostic landscape that is, well, murky to say the least.
Yeah, it is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Which is exactly our mission for you today in this deep dive. We are decoding exactly how your body keeps the score.
Spot on.
We're pulling from a pretty massive stack of sources today. We've got articles from the Truett Institute, mindliftrecovery.com, the Routine and Reason blog, and of course, the foundational research of psychiatrist Dr. Bethel van der Kolk.
Right, which is just monumental work.
It really is. So the goal here is to break down the neuroscience of why physical pain is so deeply, deeply linked to our emotional past. And we want to equip you with evidence-based, body-first paths to genuine healing.
Because, I mean, the shift in how we understand trauma over the last decade has been nothing short of a revolution.
Yeah.
And we really have to look specifically at Dr. van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score.
Yeah.
I mean, it sold over 2 million copies.
Which is wild for a medical book.
Exactly. And it's been almost 7 years on the bestseller lists.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because it fundamentally shifted the clinical focus away from the traumatic event itself.
Right, away from the what happened.
Yes. And on to the physiological aftermath. Traumatic experiences, they don't just leave like a psychological memory. They physically alter the structure and function of your brain.
So, to understand how that pain gets trapped in the body, we first have to look at the control center.
The brain.
The brain. And we're dealing primarily with two areas here, right? The amygdala and the frontal lobes.
Yeah, so think of the amygdala, which is situated deep down in the emotional center of the brain. Think of it as your body's smoke detector.
Okay.
Its entire job is survival. When it senses danger, it triggers that fight, flight, or freeze response.
Just floods your system with stress hormones.
Spot on. Adrenaline, cortisol, the works. But then you have the frontal lobes sitting right there behind your forehead. And Dr. van der Kolk calls this the watchtower.
I love that analogy.
It's brilliant. Its job is to evaluate the situation logically. So the smoke detector goes off because you smell smoke, but the watchtower looks around and goes, hold on, it's just burnt toast. Stand down.
Right. But during trauma, that balance is just completely destroyed.
It's totally knocked offline.
The brain gets stuck in this biology of threat. It completely loses the ability to distinguish between, say, a gentle breeze and an actual burglar with a crowbar.
Yes,
It's
exactly.
like, you know those faulty car alarms in your
Oh,
neighborhood?
yeah, the ones that go off at 3 a.m.
Right. It just starts blaring because a single leaf fell on the windscreen.
Yeah, and the sheer exhaustion of an alarm blaring 24 hours a day, that's what starts tearing down the physical engine of the car.
Oh.
And we actually see this happening in real-time brain scans.
Right. The flashback studies.
Yes, when Dr. van der Kolk scanned the brains of trauma patients who were actively experiencing flashbacks, the right hemisphere of the brain, so specifically the visual cortex and the right limbic area, which process emotions and images, they just lit up aggressively.
While at the exact same time, the left hemisphere, and particularly Broca's area, went almost completely dark.
Which is fascinating because Broca's area is the language center in the frontal lobe.
Right.
So when it deactivates during a flashback, the person enters what Dr. van der Kolk literally calls a state of speechless horror.
Speechless horror. That phrase, it just explains so much about why someone going through a panic attack or a severe trauma response literally cannot articulate what is wrong.
Exactly.
It's not that they're being stubborn or don't want to. The words are physically, neurologically inaccessible to them.
The language center is turned off. And the scans also revealed a failure in the brain's self-sensing areas, which is just as important.
What do you mean by self-sensing?
So, when trauma patients were simply asked to sit still and clear their minds, which is an exercise that normally activates the parts of the brain that give us a comforting awareness of our own physical presence.
Like just feeling grounded in your body.
Exactly. But for these patients, those areas stayed completely dormant.
Wow.
The brain is prioritizing external threat detection over internal physical awareness. So they end up living in a body that feels entirely unsafe and disconnected.
So if the amygdala never shuts off and the smoke detector is always blaring, then the body is never getting the all-clear signal,
Whenever.
which means the autonomic nervous system must just be marinating your organs in stress hormones indefinitely.
That is exactly what's happening. The endocrine system, which acts as the body's hormone highway, is just constantly pumping out cortisol and adrenaline.
And you cannot bathe your organs and muscles in those chemicals for years without severe biological consequences.
No, the system breaks down. And this directly drives chronic physical illness.
Which explains the massive range of physical symptoms listed across our sources today. I mean, we are looking at chronic muscle tension leading to severe spasms, migraines, fibromyalgia, chronic back and neck pain.
Irritable bowel syndrome, asthma.
Yeah, IBS and asthma.
And if we look at the mechanics of those symptoms, it actually makes perfect sense. Think about it. When your brain thinks you are actively running from a predator, it does not care about digesting your breakfast.
Right. Digestion is a luxury.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it diverts blood flow and energy away from the gut, which over time inflames the gastrointestinal tract, leading to IBS.
Makes sense.
It keeps muscles tight and ready to sprint, which leads to the widespread musculoskeletal pain we see in fibromyalgia.
And the asthma connection you mentioned earlier, that is particularly striking in the
Oh, the
sources.
case study with the woman.
Yes. There is an account of a woman suffering from severe asthma attacks that were so bad they required hospitalization.
Yeah, and traditional medical interventions just weren't solving it.
But when she realized the attacks were physical manifestations of intense childhood trauma, and she actually addressed those underlying emotions, the physical airway constriction just stopped. The asthma attacks ceased entirely.
It's incredible.
But wait, I want to pause here for a second because I think we really have to address the stigma around this.
Fair enough, yeah.
Because a lot of patients, you know, they spend years bouncing between specialists only to be told their fibromyalgia or their chronic back pain is psychosomatic.
Ugh, yes.
They are essentially told to take a deep breath, go home, and stop worrying. So when we sit here and say emotional trauma causes asthma or back pain, are people going to think we are saying the pain is all in your head?
That is such an important point. And it's a profound failure of modern medicine when doctors do that, and a complete misunderstanding of the science.
Right.
The pain is 100% physically real. The tissue damage is physiological. The muscles are genuinely spasming, and the gut is genuinely inflamed.
It's not imaginary.
Not at all. The origin of the signal might be emotional, but the biological wear and tear is measurable and devastating.
And the Truett Institute research takes this a step further, doesn't it? It's not just the body reacting to the brain. The brain actually processes emotional and physical pain in the exact same physical locations.
This is one of my favorite studies. They demonstrate that taking acetaminophen, so standard paracetamol, actually reduces the neural responses to social rejection.
Wait, really? Paracetamol for a broken heart?
Literally,
Yeah.
neurologically speaking, it dulls the distress of social rejection in the exact same way it dulls the physical throb of a sprained ankle.
That is wild.
The brain does not strictly differentiate between the two types of agony. The neural pathways are shared.
That completely reframes how we experience emotion. And the Routine Reason blog highlights how this isn't just like some clinical lab discovery. It's something we've intuitively known across cultures for centuries.
Oh, the emotional body maps.
Yes, we see these consistent emotional body maps everywhere. People universally describe anger as a literal heat or tightness in the chest, right? Or anxiety as a physical knot in the stomach.
Yeah, our language completely reflects this somatic memory.
You
We say
know,
we are heartbroken or we have a gut feeling.
because our bodies map these emotions physically, because the nervous system does not separate the mind from the flesh.
No, they are one continuous loop.
So if the damage is housed in the physical tissues and driven by the survival brain, it highlights a pretty massive flaw in how we've traditionally treated trauma.
Oh, hugely. Because talk therapy relies entirely on logic.
Right.
It requires the frontal lobes, the watchtower, to be fully online to process narratives and make sense of the past.
But the trauma lives in the survival brain, the amygdala, and the survival brain does not respond to reason or language.
Not even a little bit.
You can't sit there and negotiate with a reflex. Like if you accidentally touch a hot stove, your hand pulls away before your conscious brain even registers the heat, right?
Exactly.
You can't just talk your hand into staying on the burner by laying out a logical argument.
Now, hand, let's think about this reasonably.
Exactly. So why would we assume we can sit on a couch and talk a dysregulated nervous system out of being terrified?
You can't reason with a fire alarm. And honestly, more importantly, heavily relying on talk therapy can often backfire.
How so?
Constantly recalling and verbally rehashing traumatic events can actually cause re-traumatization. Remember how we said Broca's area, the language center, shuts down during a flashback?
The speechless horror?
Yes. So when you force a patient to talk about their trauma before their nervous system actually feels safe, you're just throwing them back into that state of speechless horror.
Wow. So their heart rate spikes, the stress hormones flood back into the bloodstream.
And it just leads to avoidance and treatment failure.
That makes so much sense. Now, I should mention, the sources do point out that some skeptics argue against the literal interpretation of cellular memory, this idea that your muscle fibers are storing memories like a USB drive.
Yeah, and the scientific community is careful about treating cellular memory as a literal mechanism rather than a metaphor.
Right. We want to be precise.
But even the most rigorous skeptics acknowledge the core reality here. Chronic stress leaves undeniable lasting damage on the physical nervous system. The exact cellular mechanism might be debated, but the physiological outcome, that dysregulation, is agreed upon across the board.
So we need treatments that speak the body's language. If we can't logic our way out, we have to look at bottom-up approaches, right? Treatments that bypass the analytical brain and foster neuroplasticity.
Yes, neuroplasticity is the key here. It's the brain's ability to adapt, to rewire its structural connections, and to form completely new neural pathways.
Because the brain adapted to survive the trauma by staying on high alert.
Right. So through neuroplasticity, it can be physically rewired to feel safe again.
And the sources outline a really clear progression for this. Starting with internal nervous system regulation, we're looking at things like somatic experiencing and mindfulness.
Which is all about learning to notice physical sensations and calm the body before touching the traumatic memories.
And Dr. Van der Kolk's research highlights yoga specifically, which I found fascinating. He found that yoga had better results for treating PTSD than any of the drug studies conducted to date.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is, but why? Why does holding a physical posture outperform pharmaceuticals?
Well, it comes down to reteaching the nervous system how to handle distress. When you hold a challenging yoga pose for, say, 10 deep breaths, it is physically uncomfortable.
Well, definitely. My legs are shaking.
Right. Your heart rate might elevate slightly. Your muscles start to burn. But by breathing steadily through it, you teach your amygdala a fundamental lesson. Discomfort eventually fades.
Oh, wow.
You are proving to your own brain that difficult physical sensations do not equate to a life or death threat. It rebuilds that trust between the mind and the physical vessel.
That is so powerful. Okay, so once that baseline of safety is established, the sources move into neurological reprogramming. And we see EMDR brought up constantly, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
A total game changer.
But okay, let's unpack this. Because on paper, moving your eyes back and forth while thinking about a memory sounds completely disconnected from healing chronic pain. How does simply tracking a finger rewrite a physical pain response?
Okay, so it leverages a neurological quirk called the orienting response.
Mm.
When you track a therapist's fingers or a light moving side to side, it actually taxes your working memory.
Okay.
Your brain is forced to remain anchored in the present physical moment to track that movement. And while your eyes are tracking, you briefly recall the past trauma.
So you are forcing the brain to divide its attention.
Precisely. This bilateral stimulation helps the brain process the memory without the amygdala sounding the alarm, because the brain is just too busy dealing with the immediate physical task of eye tracking. It takes a memory that feels like an active present-day threat and essentially files it away in the brain's archives as a historical event.
It safely belongs in the past.
Exactly. And it often works rapidly, entirely bypassing the need for complex language.
Which avoids that speechless horror trap.
Spot on.
Another technology-driven approach to this reprogramming is neurofeedback, which the MindLift article details. This one sounds like sci-fi. You are essentially playing a video game, but you're hooked up to an EEG, so sensors that measure the electrical activity and brain waves in your head.
Yeah, and the game only progresses, or you only earn points, when those electrical signals reflect an optimal, calm brainwave state.
It's gamifying nervous system regulation.
It really is.
You aren't using a controller. You are using your brain's physical state.
And the mechanism here relies on subconscious reward loops. It doesn't require deliberate conscious control from the patient. The brain naturally wants the reward in the game, so it subconsciously figures out how to shift its own electrical activity to get the points. And over time, through that neuroplasticity we discussed, this trains the brain to self-regulate. It makes it much easier for the person to automatically drop into a calm state when faced with real-world stressors.
It's like you are taking your nervous system to the gym.
Literally building that muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so once the internal regulation and neurological reprogramming are underway, the sources point to a final stage. External communal integration. Things like theater and movements.
Yes, the social engagement system.
They mention programs like Shakespeare in the courts. And I love this because if trauma makes a person want to shrink, right, to physically make themselves small and unnoticeable to avoid danger, acting forces the exact opposite.
You have to stand tall, open your chest, project your voice, and occupy physical space.
It's so vulnerable.
It is. But by intentionally adopting the physical posture of confidence and power, you send a bottom-up signal to your brain that you are safe enough to be seen.
Wow.
Furthermore, it rebuilds a profound sense of community and synchrony with others, which trauma deeply, deeply fractures. I think the most empowering takeaway from all of this is the massive shift in perspective. Trauma isn't just an event trapped in your past. It is a physical imprint carried in your present biology. But you are not broken beyond repair.
No, not at all.
Your body and your brain are highly capable of being rewired for safety.
Healing doesn't always have to be an excruciating verbal deep dive into your darkest memories.
Right.
Often it has to start with the physical tissue.
So pay attention to your own physical signals. Are you constantly clenching your jaw during a routine meeting?
Right.
Are your shoulders perpetually creeping up by your ears? Are you dealing with chronic digestive issues or fatigue that no amount of sleep seems to fix?
You have to ask yourself what your nervous system might be trying to communicate.
Yeah. And remember, healing can start with something as simple as taking one deep, intentional breath or doing a few minutes of mindful movement just to prove to your body that it is safe right now.
And you know, if we look at the broader implications of this science, it leaves us with a rather profound societal question.
Oh, totally.
The CDC cites childhood trauma as our single largest public health issue. And Dr. Vinderkolk explicitly notes that traumatized human beings recover best in the context of communal, rhythmic relationships, literally moving and feeling safe with other people.
Right. So if our biology is this deeply dependent on physical connection, movement, and community, could the very structure of our modern society be the problem?
It's a huge question.
We live in these isolated, screen-heavy, highly sedentary environments. If human beings require communal rhythm to regulate our nervous systems, modern life itself might be acting as a low-grade constant trauma.
Yeah, straight up.
Which means the ultimate cure for our epidemic of chronic pain isn't just found inside a clinic or a therapy room. It might require us to radically redesign how our communities actually live, gather, and move together.
When the pain is an alarm bell ringing from a dysregulated nervous system,
you
cannot just put a cast on it. You have to teach the body and the community around it how to feel safe again.
Well, the X-ray machine might be broken, but the muddy waters are definitely starting to clear. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take a deep breath, drop your shoulders, and we'll see you next time.